biggest challenge, quite frankly, challenging black labor right now, as opposed to 50 years ago, is grappling with the changes in the labor market between now and then. I mean, I think 50 years ago, to a large degree, the issue was black people trying to get into workforces that they were excluded from. And I think now that's the same struggle to some degree, but I think the bigger challenge is that there's another low-wage workforce that's being brought into the country, and the biggest challenge is how to build solidarity across racial lines and across national and ethnic boundaries.
So we have a government that then has all of these nice little pretty laws, but nobody is enforcing them. So, you know, you might come and say, well, you know, this is a great city, this is that. No, we're all dressed up and nowhere to go.
Controversy is a powerful and positive thing, particularly when it is set in the context of a social justice, moral rectitude, and I think that's who Fidel Castro was.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. On our first show for the last month of this tumultuous year, 2016, that has included so much that will go down in history, including 1 week ago, Comandante Fidel Castro Ruiz, leader of the Cuban Revolution, joining the ancestors at the age of 90. This year also marked the 50th anniversary of the call for black power in this country in 1966, 7 years after the victory of the Cuban Revolution, and during a time when similar liberation movements in Africa, Asia, and the Americas were rising up against colonialism and all forms of capitalist European and American hegemony. Today is the first in the series of our shows this month that will explore Black Power 50 years in D.C., 1966 to 2016. Black economic power in the District of Columbia is our focus today, and we'll bring you voices from the recent program, Black Labor in D.C., Past, Present, Future, and Intersections with Solidarity Organizing, sponsored by One D.C. and Resource Generation. So you know the drill. We have a lot packed into this less than an hour. And before we go to Black Power 50 years in D.C., here are our headlines. Now, based solely on the skewed news reports in the lamestream media, you would not know that 90% of the world, perhaps more than 90%, 99% of the world loved and revered Fidel Castro as a revolutionary leader who led a people's revolution to victory over a brutal dictator backed by the United States. Victory over the forces of neocolonialism and empire. Heads of state from all over the world visited Cuba this week to pay respects. All around the world, community-led vigils and tributes sprang up to honor the life and work of Fidel Castro. Here in D.C., the impromptu organizing included a program Thursday night, Reflections on Cuba and Fidel, sponsored by the Institute for Policy Studies. Chantel James has more.
In the wake of Fidel Castro's passing just 1 week ago, an event held at the Institute for Policy Studies in DuPont Circle celebrated his life. Initially framed as a discussion with Miguel Fraga, the event evolved into a film screening and audience dialogue with IPS board member James Early. The films Fidel is Fidel and Saul Landau's Fidel highlighted the charismatic leadership of Castro. After they were shown, the floor opened for a brief discussion about the future of U.S.-Cuba relations. Here, James Early gives his take on the legacy of Castro.
Well, I always disliked it when people said Fidel Castro was controversial. I knew what the word controversy means. I thought I did. I went and I looked at it, and I said, yes, Fidel Castro was controversial. People argued about him. I have come to believe that his greatest legacy is his social justice ethic. And when he put it forth, people divided up. They stood on one side of the line or the other. They didn't all stand in the same quadrant, but I thought controversy is a powerful and positive thing, particularly when it is set in the context of a social justice, moral rectitude, and I think that's who Fidel Castro was, and turned that into policy that other generations have picked up in their own individuality, their own creativity, to institutionalize that. He was a man of great ideas. He read. As you can see, he sat with people, as he said. You must engage life as it is. You can't do that from your office. You can't do that simply sitting at your computer. You must get out and be among the people. And for many years I thought, how did the cult of personality develop around him? And I found that quite disturbing. There are people who come along once in a while, sometimes if we are fortunate in our lifetimes, who attract the interest and concentrate the aspirations of people from all walks of life. And that is part of what made him so extraordinary. I think his greatest contribution in terms of his writing is social justice. It's right or it's wrong. It's just or it's unjust. And people responded to that. And now is a very important time for us to hear our voices, not only in this room this evening, but our voices in all walks of life that we're engaged in.
For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
December 1st marked World AIDS Day and also Rosa Parks Day, the day the civil rights pioneer was arrested and sparked the historic civil rights movement. Also across the nation on December 1st was a day of protests at Wells Fargo banks demanding that they divest from the Dakota Access Pipeline project. This week, 2,000 veterans headed to North Dakota to act as a human shield for the water protectors who have been opposing the $3.8 billion pipeline. Another day of global protest against the pipeline, including a protest here in D.C., is planned for December 10th. Also on Thursday, there was a National Day of Action held against the dollar stores. More than 65 demonstrations, manager meetings, and other tactics were used by communities and groups across the nation to push Dollar Tree to get toxins out of their products they sell. Actions were coordinated in 26 states sponsored by the Campaign for Healthier Solutions. In this clip, activists with the Healthy Children Project participating in protests spoke on this video posted on Facebook.
Every family deserves safe and healthy products, but every day we are exposed to toxic chemicals in the products we buy. The Learning Disabilities Association is visiting Dollar Tree stores across the United States to ask the company to get toxic chemicals linked to learning disabilities, autism, ADHD, and other health concerns out of their products. We are here today as part of the Campaign for Healthier Solutions and participating in this National Day of Action. Dollar Tree, we ask that you join other companies and tell your suppliers to get toxic chemicals out of your products.
Also, following up on environmental justice news that we have reported in recent weeks, those residents in West Virginia who were finally able to speak to the Environmental Protection Agency about a pollution from the January 2014 Freedom Industries spill into the Elk River received good news that the mandated cleanup of their community is a rule voted on in Congress, which means that it can't be touched by the Trump administration. In other planet news, climate change and resultant natural disasters, droughts, and sea level rise could lead to a humanitarian crisis of epic proportions, senior military figures told The Guardian on Thursday. In culture and media, The Washington Post has drawn ire and ridicule this week after they published a McCarthy-era style article, which included a so-called blacklist of journalists, bloggers, and news organizations the Post considered to be too close to Russia. Writing in Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi called the article disgraceful. This Sunday's Actor, a continuing talk on race at Busboys and Poets 14th and V Streets, features On Being White and Woke with author and anti-racism activist Tim Wise. And in movie theaters, the critically praised movie Loving is in wider release now. It tells the story of Richard and Mildred Loving, the couple who fought and won a Supreme Court case that struck down state laws against interracial marriage in the United States. And those are some of the headlines and happenings. When we come back, Black labor in D.C., past, present, future, and intersections with solidarity organizing. Stay with us.
What did we want? And the response from the crowd was Black power. And Stokely started out by saying, what do we want? And then he answered. And then he'd asked again, what do we want? And then the crowd got involved in and engaged.
What do you want? Everybody, what do you want? That's what we're gonna get. We've been built and we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about, as sure as you born. But just as sure as it takes two eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we.
This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Verum. This year marked the 50th anniversary of the call for Black power in this country in 1966. And next is the first in the series of segments this month that will explore Black power 50 years in D.C., 1966 to 2016. Black economic power in the District of Columbia is our focus today. A 2015 study by the Economic Policy Institute found that African American employment is high across the country and highest here in Washington, D.C. Next are voices from the recent program, Black Labor in D.C., Past, Present, Future, and Intersections with Solidarity Organizing, sponsored by One D.C. and Resource Generation. Participating on the panel is the activist Eugene Perrier, labor leader Kimberly Mitchell, and Ime Ho, associate director of Resource Generation, an organization that works toward equitable distribution of wealth, class, and power.
First and foremost, thank you so much to Resource Generation and 1DC for putting this on, and I really am grateful for the opportunity to speak here and have a dialogue with you all. I think that for me it's an important subject. I mean, to some degree it's why I moved here. I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia, not to slight it, but I wanted to move to a place that was at least what I knew D.C. to be. Perhaps I was educated once I got here, which was the Chocolate City. I have a lot of friends and family in the area, and I was looking to put myself in a position. I'd already been organizing for several years where I could connect more directly to Black working class communities and people and start to dig in and work there. The first thing I ever did was the Coalition to Save Our Neighborhood Schools, which is working around neighborhood education here in Washington, D.C., which certainly a good introduction to that issue. I mean, why it's important to me, I mean, I could sort of say maybe on the meta sense, but I think in the more specific sense to Washington, D.C., it's also because it seems like it's work that has to be done if there isn't going to be a complete elimination of Black working people in this region. I think that Washington, D.C., similar to cities like San Francisco and other places, to a large degree, even sort of the traditional role of Black workers in a quote-unquote service sector of the economy has been drastically reduced, that inside of Washington, D.C., our concentration has been vastly reduced via gentrification, and that to some degree we are highly superfluous to the broader system. And even beyond that, I think we now have an educational system that is geared towards a new form of tracking. This whole idea, and this is what you'll hear from every single D.C. politician, that, well, not everyone has to go to college, which in some general sense may be true, but what they really mean is they want to send every single person into a career high school so that you have to decide in ninth grade whether you want to be a philosopher, a baker, or someone who works the front desk at a hotel. And I think that's just the type of existence that is, it's really criminal to force children to readjust their horizons to one of five different careers that you've pre-selected for them and say, oh, well, it's a pipeline to a job. So to me, it's extraordinary. Important because I think that it's indicative of a lot of things, but what I came here to do and the communities I came here to be a part of are so rapidly disappearing, and they're not going to stick around unless we have a strong focus on organizing and on quality jobs for all people. So I think to some degree that's why this is so important to me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the panel. I'm really honored to be here today with these two panelists. And so for me, I'm the Associate Director of Resource Generation. I'm here to speak from that perspective. I identify as a young person with wealth and class privilege. And so why is this personally important to me? So at Resource Generation, we believe that the equitable distribution of land, wealth, and power cannot happen unless we address racism, in particular, anti-Black racism. Like, we know that the accumulation of wealth is a direct result of stolen land and stolen labor, historically in this country. Those two things are tied together, and that is the history of wealth accumulation in this country, and that's resulted in a huge racial wealth divide where, you know, the average, like, median financial wealth of a Black household is $5,000 compared to over $100,000 for a white family. In 2009, we know that that disparity increases even more when you look at gender, women of color, compared to white men. And so we understand if we're organizing young people with wealth, if we're organizing around economic justice, that we also have to address racism. And so that's from the big picture view of organizationally, like, our priorities and our values. But what does that have to do with me? I'm Asian American. My parents immigrated here. My family is not complicit in genocide or the transatlantic slave trade. But need to acknowledge that if I'm here, then I'm part of the racial hierarchy as president in the United States. And just being here, especially as an East Asian person, as part of the model minority myth that pits East Asians in particular against black and brown people, that I have systematically benefited from anti-black racism, and so has my family. And my parents are immigrants, and they're in the South. I grew up in North Carolina. They've, of course, experienced a lot of racism, a lot of xenophobia. They don't speak English as their first language. And yet they had education privilege. They have immigration privilege. They were able to get jobs and not be criminalized and get benefit of the doubt that a lot of black people don't get that benefit of the doubt. And so I need to acknowledge that, like, my family legacy, my access to my parents' resources, and like my education privilege is in some way like due to anti-black racism. And so that's my own like personal connection and my own commitment to the work. And I also want to name that the category of Asian American is always incredibly complex and includes a lot of different people. And so what I'm saying might not apply to like South Asian folks who experience a little homophobia, like Southeast Asian folks who are refugees or Pacific Islanders. And so we're not a monolith, but I'm speaking from my own personal experience. And so, and just in terms of like DC, I actually live in Northern Virginia, so I'm a little bit like, I have like imposter syndrome because I'm like, oh, I don't really live in DC, you're putting me on this panel, I like work in DC kind of, and so just to like be transparent about that, I've lived in Northern Virginia for 8 years. But I think too, as a young millennial that came into this area in 2008 after Obama was elected, like, you know, I'm into the whiskey bars and the craft cocktails and the artisanal cheese, and like that's great, but like I'm also thinking about what kind of city do I want to live in, like what kind of place do I want to be a part of. And I don't believe that DC should be built around my needs and like my consumption as like a wealthy person and as a young millennial. And so that's also the stake that I have, is I think, yeah, I want to support black residents of DC, and I want to support black workers here.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to my brothers and sisters in the struggle, and to those of you who don't think that you are. So basically, I like to pretty much start with the part that says, what brings you to this work? Well, I didn't come to the work. I found myself in the middle of it. I have worked and I've lived in DC basically all my life. I just turned 50 October the 10th. And I actually started my first job at the RFK Stadium. We had the real Risk and Hogs, and that job happened to be organized. It happened to be organized. It was my first union job. I work at Macy's, as you know, which is also unionized. What I didn't know then was how much the difference between being in a union store and being organized, the difference that it has made as far as the quality of work that I now do as a retailer. Basically, I've been in the city for such a long time. I was here when D.C. was Chocolate City. I remember going through Reaganomics, and at that particular time, I was in my 20s. So even though I had a car and I had just recently moved back home, I didn't really understand what Reaganomics was. But to now be here today and be a mom and a homeowner and, you know, and have a car and everything, I'm like, oh, so this is what life is really is. And I'm glad that my daughter is 16 at this time, because actually she is just recognizing the change that D.C. has had in the last 10 years. So for her to be 16 going to 17, but she actually goes to a trade school, and hospitality is actually one of the industries that they're pushing her to. I would like to know if that's because she wants to be a wedding planner, which to me is a meeting planner. But I need to make sure that that's a strong job for her that's going to be unionized, that so that if she decides that that's the field that she wants to stay in, that she can also get quality jobs and excellent benefits. So another reason why it's important to me is because I have a lot of workers who have been at Macy's for 45, 50 years easily. And to now see that in their prime time as our elders, which we should respect, to now see them being disrespected when they have put so much hard time in, to now be like, we don't need you anymore. So I look at me being the voice for the people who don't have a voice, the people who are scared to talk up, because they remember the time. They remember the time now, which I'm pretty sure to them seems like it's deja vu, because here we are in the Trump era where he has just now bought up old wounds. But everything happens for a reason, because maybe this time we can do some healing and do some real change.
Okay. Our second question this evening is, how has organizing Black labor and solidarity in D.C. changed? Can you provide examples from your own career?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I can provide some examples from my own career, but to make the point relevant, maybe it's worth... I'm someone who tries to study a lot of history of previous and past movements. I mean, I think to some degree, a lot of what we do now and a lot of what people who are focusing around quote-unquote social justice do now, you know, we're not really reinventing the wheel, even though sometimes we think we are. And I think that's, you know, just a function of a lack of historical memory. So to me, sort of the key piece of change in looking back historically is that increasingly over time, and even in the short time I've been here, I've lived here since 2004. I went to Howard University. I came here in the fall of 2004. Black worker organizing has become increasingly not led by Black working people. I mean, they've become the object, not the subject of it. And by that, what I mean is, and one, I think that we have to have a more expansive view. I mean, I think that working people, working class people, I mean, there are sort of quote unquote on the job issues that are, you know, whatever, you're organizing around a higher wage, better benefits, in perhaps this current era to create co-ops and other forms of alternative economic institutions. So something that's considered sort of a directly quote unquote worker organizing issue. But I think it's also important to recognize, and perhaps those in this room do, that there's so many subsidiary issues, transportation, housing, and so on and so forth. And if you really look at the history of Washington, there's an unbelievably rich history of workers, Black workers, organizing themselves around a variety of their collective concerns. I mean, you could even look at hotel and restaurant organizing over the years, the traditional labor force in Washington, D.C. being Black people, even some of the earliest federal government unions, the U.S. Postal Service, Wildcat, things like that that have existed that focus on that, but also around broader life issues. For instance, in the 1940s specifically, but also sort of leading into the 1950s, the campaign to integrate capital transit. So D.C. was traditionally a southern city. So well into the 1950s, public transportation was segregated. But a movement arose in the early 1940s as a broader part of the March on Washington movement led by A. Philip Randolph, and then later around the struggle around the FEPC, which was to get Black people jobs in the war industries at the same level, that involved many radical organizers, many communists, many socialists, but directly from the unions and the community in and of itself to organize to integrate the buses. I won't go through the whole thing, but ultimately they were successful, but it was much later on. You also have the early days of Marion Barry coming to Washington, D.C., the bus boycotts he led, the Free D.C. movement. I mean, sort of the more about the aspect of democratic rights for Black people, the ability to have the opportunity to have self-determination and political power, and that's the ability of that to then impact on the ability to create a quote-unquote middle class, to create jobs. I mean, to some degree, it was those early struggles that opened up the possibilities politically to use the public sector in order to create more of these jobs that were decent and could support people. And so much of that work was emanating directly from the Black community. When I first came here, you know, most of the things I got involved with politically were like the Coalition to Save Our Neighborhood Schools, which was all working class Black parents who organized with zero cash, no money, no support against the biggest, you know, corporations in the world and billionaires supporting charter schools. The Jobs Not Jails Coalition, I was the only non-returning citizen who worked on that. They recruited me because I was a college student, so I didn't have to work, so I could like do all the administrative work. But it was extraordinarily enlightening to be around these people who had, most of whom been radicalized inside of prison in some period between the late 60s and the mid-1980s, early 1990s, come out and were trying to make a difference and have been involved in so many different pieces over the years. And we ended up leading the very first Ban the Box in D.C., and we failed. And this leads to my final point. It succeeded the next year, and it succeeded because essentially returning citizens as an entity were usurped in that organizing and were replaced by well-funded nonprofits. And the change I've seen over these years, another thing I'll just mention, this is tangentially, that I used to love doing. We worked at DC Jobs or Else, and we would take like hundreds of people and just roll up on construction sites that wouldn't hire Black people and just shut them down. We would do stuff like that. It was emanating from the community. And it seems to me that in that same time period, we've shifted now to a frame where all quote unquote organizing happens, you know, only in specific silos around specific issues. It happens under the guise of very particularized nonprofits, many of which are run by, staffed by, and controlled by non-black people, and even to the extent they hire a few, it's like a tokenistic aspect, and the people who fund it certainly aren't that. Some of them are the federal city council and the people pushing these policies that are destroying black workers, so that's an interesting irony. And workers, black workers, have become the object, not the subject. They've become the people to have, the props to have at your Wilson Building rally, the people you trot out to testify in front of the council, and so on and so forth, but not the people driving it, which I have to say is one of the things that when I first met 1DC, I was skeptical, because I said, oh, it's just another one of those nonprofits, you know? And from day one, it was very clear to me that this was an organization that, despite having whatever the little 501 whatever is, was 100% focused around how do you empower people to lead themselves so that the so-called organizers could walk away and do something else, and the skills that you've given communities in the course of one struggle can be transferred to another struggle. And so to me, it's the professionalization of organizing that I think is not a... It's not an accident that it ended up that way, but the professionalization of organizing, which has taken away the agency of so much of our communities. And to me, that's been the biggest change, even in this just short period of time from 04 to now, where so much of the work that used to have to be, you know, MacGyver put together with a, you know, a piece of gum and a piece of tape, now like someone swoops in with a $500,000 grant that you've never heard of to work on the exact same issue you've been working on for 30 years. So to me, that's been the biggest change in that time, both historically and in my own career.
So basically, for me being a mom, we have been organizing mothers and grandparents and things like that. We've been organizing schools, churches, dinners, family reunions, and so most of those people who have done that, you know, organizing before organizing was popular or whatever, however you want to say it, I think they have forgotten that they did that work, and I think they have gotten complacent, and I think that they feel like maybe they're not needed. So just recently I spoke to at a church in regards to a lot of women, it was Women's Day, that just have gray hair, and I had to remind them that they are needed. You know, this is the work that they used to do, and that we need them to come back out. Any type of organizing that you're doing, you have got to make sure that the true players are at the table. I mean, it's amazing to me when I first got into this work, and I kept hearing that everybody was going to meetings, like meeting this, meeting. I'm like, okay, what are you guys all meeting about? And then when I found out they were meeting about the issues that actually concern me, I'm like, well, how can you possibly have a meeting and I'm not at the table, or that young person's not at the table, or that black person, Asian person, or whatever the issue is? Because we can save you guys a lot of time and a lot of energy, and maybe we could really get some really serious organizing together and win some campaigns. But you cannot do it without us. So that's the main thing going forward. I hope that all of you remember that you can save yourself a lot of time and a lot of money by actually having the worker at the table for all of these meetings. And so in regards to 1DC, you know, I was talking to people about just general things, and, you know, 1DC kept coming up, and I was like, wow, you know, but being a retailer, I heard this concept that 1DC has as far as co-ops, as far as I'm a small business owner. And of course, we always want to be able to maintain our clientele and, you know, and deal with places like Macy's and things like that. So I was like, okay, you always hear co-op in regards to food, organic food and things like that. So to hear that concept in retail, that really made the light bulb go off, like, wow. You know, so I thank you for all the work that 1DC does. And to actually have come in and hear about your program with the 18 and 36, and trust me, as soon as my daughter gets 18, I'm coming to see you. Thank you.
I'm the type of person, I believe in all worker organizing, all labor organizing. I just, as an individual, I just think that to me, not only should a job be a human right, but that a decent job that can actually provide some type of living that you can, you know, I don't know, feel good about and not wake up every morning feeling terrible about yourself is 100% key. When I think about the in particular piece and why I really like the concept of black workers' centers as they seem to be metastasizing across the country is, there's a guy, it's an interesting book if you ever want to read it, a guy named Roger Walding, or some of you may have read his book, it's called Still the Promised City. It's one of my favorite books because the reason for the book is that he's describing how the labor market is a niche labor market, right? Like his attitude, the reason that he decided to write the book was he was trying to figure out why it is that in all black communities, none of the corner stores are owned by black people by and large. Like that to him seemed like it didn't make sense. So what he learned, it was an interesting concept, was that in the course of the post-civil rights era, and for people who know this history, you are certainly familiar with this, you had basically the extension or the promise of the extension of the social contract, the post-World War II social contract to black Americans. And the idea was, okay, the positions in the factories that you don't have, you're going to get. The positions in the public sector you've been kept out of, you're going to get. Some of the white-collar jobs you haven't been able to get, we're going to open that up. And so essentially we're going to try to find a way to integrate black people into the broader post-war consensus, the same way like it wasn't until after World War II that you really even had like white people. My dad is from Newark, New Jersey. He passed in 2010. He was 80 years old. He grew up in the 30s, and back then he was telling me there was no like white people in Newark. You had Poles, you had Italians, you had Irish, and a lot of them hated each other. And it was really sort of the homogenization post-World War II that led to this, that okay, we can recreate that a second time. And so ultimately that ends up not being the case because of the economic crisis of the 70s. So by the time, and there's a great Urban League study from 77 called Last Hired, First Fired, also about this concept. And so by the time black people kind of realize, like, wait a second, none of the stuff they told us we were going to be able to do, none of the things we've been fighting for, none of the positions are even going to be there. They're going to move some of this, you know, to some other country. It was too late because newly arriving immigrants had pounced on the white flight opportunities from mostly Jewish store owners leaving these neighborhoods and taking over these stores. So then you had a situation where black people were shut out. So what he then scales this up to mean in the book is that there's not like one labor market. Like when we go out there and we apply for jobs, it's not just like I'm applying for the same job, you're applying for the same job, but all sorts of different things from race to gender to sexual orientation, whatever, are going to impact heavily on what jobs you're able to get, what's open to you, what kind of discrimination is there, and that the niche labor market is what determines why there's so many disparities between different types of people, because the labor market is not responding to some general need for jobs, but also the specific realities that have been set up because of history, discrimination, bigotry, and so on and so forth. So I think what's exciting about black labor organizing and the focus of black worker centers is it's a recognition of that fact. That obviously all workers need dignity and respect and better jobs to some degree, but that at the same time, if we're going to build a movement that values that, it also has to have the sectoral piece. It has to have the piece that recognizes the particular challenges faced by the black community. Or, for instance, you know, the transgender community, which 50% of women in Washington, D.C. are unemployed. So obviously there's specific instances for certain communities that have to be dealt with specificity. There's certain realities about discrimination in the workplace which speak to raising up things like co-ops and things like that, for instance. You have so many people, anyone who's ever lived in Southeast and Northeast, who work in basically the gray market. You know what I mean? They're cutting grass, they're doing whatever, they're doing it unofficially. So they're already working. But how do you formalize that? So some of the things, the labor patterns, the discrimination elements, all of that is extraordinarily important. And so I think that that's why, you know, what 1DC is doing with the Black Workers Center and what is happening around the country with Black Workers Centers and other types of communities that sort of dealing with the more sectoral nature is critically important, because we'll never get it with just sort of like a one size fits all type of situation. We can raise that up as a slogan, but when we do the particular work, I think we have to be able to drill down. So to me, that's why it's so key.
If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam, and we're listening to Black Labor in D.C., Past, Present, Future, and Intersections with Solidarity Organizing, sponsored by 1DC and Resource Generation, being presented as part of our coverage of Black Power 50 Years in D.C., 1966 to 2016. Participating on the panel is the activist Eugene Perrier, labor leader Kimberly Mitchell, and Ime Ho, Associate Director of Resource Generation, an organization that works toward equitable distribution of wealth, class, and power. More after this brief break.
Some people mad is in your way. No more tears do we cry. And we have finally dried our eyes. We're moving on up. Moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. We're moving
just yesterday, I was in Home Depot. And, you know, Home Depot used to be a lot of people who had a trade, and they actually knew what they were doing. And I kid you not, I think everybody in there was actually a black African-American woman that did not have the slightest idea of what they were doing. And so, you know, and so I remember one of my friends who was a woman who worked for as a manager at Home Depot in a couple of years. I remember her saying, yeah, you know, Home Depot is focusing on this new program, and they want to get women workers, and they, you know, they want to develop them. No, they're not developing them. You know, and it's just like the workers that work at Macy's today. I remember when I started working at Macy's, we did maybe like a week of training with a real live trainer. And so what we have now is that you now get a job and they train you on the computer. At least that's what we had a couple of months ago. Now what we actually have is associates coming in the store, and I kid you not, a young lady walked up to me and she had this pamphlet and she started to question me. And so I said to her, I said, sweetie, what are you doing? And she says, oh, well, I'm new. And then I looked, she had a badge on that said training. So now she's left the computer to actually walking on the floor and self-training herself. So what we have here is an assembly line of workers. And so if you go into the store now, because remember the lie was that all fast food workers and, you know, retailers were teenagers and people underneath a certain age. And then as we started to organize around that and say, no, workers at these jobs are actually adults, but they have made a way to get rid of us or eliminate us in such ways as losing points or cutting our hours so that we don't have enough hours to then sustain to hold of our families. And so now what you have had is older sector, as far as my age, a lot of people have got frustrated or even older have been told by their family to come on home and just retire. So now you have these younger workers who are unorganized, who have not received any training, and then what they have set up is just an assembly line. So these are workers who they come in, if they're lucky, if they get past their 90-day probational period because of so many things put on them. And, you know, of course they don't want them to really be there past the 90 days anyway because they'll use that labor, get them out, get another group in, get, you know, whatever tax breaks, federal breaks that they get. And so it's very important that we teach the younger people and help to organize them to let them know, like, no, this is not the way that things are supposed to be. So education is definitely a key, and they don't know, and they're being used and abused. But women more so now, because most of our men are still locked up or they have just totally given up, and that due to their own cause. You know, a lot of times you hear these, as you know, these statistics about unemployment and unemployment is good. No, not in the ward. I'm from Ward 7. And so, you know, the number that might be right in Ward 7 is unemployment is like 9%. I think in Ward 8 is 11%. That might be the right number, but who knows? But the other reason why organizing, we have to focus on black labor, because we remember before Reaganomics, most of the people who lived in the district when we actually had a thriving district, we did have issues. But they were school teachers, they were federal workers. Reaganomics turned around, and they a lot of folks got riffed. A lot of the government jobs that were, you know, good paying jobs, they ended up turning around and then doing contract work. So, and then after Reaganomics, we had all these jobs come up, but they were all low paying jobs. You know, when you go in Dunkin' Donuts and things like that, those are jobs that are not paying any benefits or not paying anything, and they're not going anywhere. So, you know, that's why we have to, and these jobs were, and when we were Chocolate City, that's what they were. They were people of color. And even now, if you go downtown D.C. where we are, they still are people of color. So that's why it's important that we organize them and get them involved.
Thank you. So you all actually touched on this. I mean, that question was, you know, why focus on black labor today? And interestingly, each of you touched on intersectionality. So what are the other parts of identity that intersect with labor, and you know, what are the stories, and how can we add that to this conversation? So that was one of our later questions, so I just want to keep this open for a minute. If you do have something else to add, you know, about other identities that intersect with labor and this conversation, and what are some of the experiences that you might want to share in this space? And I know you've already done that, but if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I'll name immigration status as, yeah, definitely an identity and privilege to consider in terms of documentation and the ability to work here. As we know, some of the most exploited workers in this country are people who do not have legal documentation. And I think that's a very intentional strategy around keeping kind of like a permanent workforce of folks that do not have access to benefits, do not have like access to organized labor, can be threatened with deportation, and are very, very vulnerable. So I want to name that, and especially this is like a very live issue for, I know, the Asian American community, and of course the Latino community. We mentioned sexuality. Eugene mentioned sexuality. Trans folks have some of the highest rates of unemployment and homelessness in the country. Of course, when you add race, like trans people of color, black trans people, black trans women in particular, like highly experience a lot of violence and employment discrimination.
Well, I just want to piggyback on that because I think that's all a good thing. And I think it's something that's very important. And if you're new to D.C., something that's, and maybe not new, but new to politics, important to grasp is, you know, the people who run this city are fantastic at rhetorically recognizing many of these things. And so, for example, you deal with transgender employment. I mentioned that there is about 50% unemployment. There allegedly is a program, Operation Power, that they set up 3 or 4 years ago that was supposed to deal with that, and no one really got a job. So it came out with all this big fanfare, and all the politicians came, and they got their picture taken, and they put out their press release, and they said, we're dealing with transgender unemployment, but now no one is following up. And I think one of the biggest things in Washington, D.C., and one of the most important areas of organizing is accountability. Because this is a city, a state, if you will, that will pass almost anything that looks progressive and sounds progressive and helps people in their next election campaign. But they'll either write so many loopholes into it or make it impossible to enforce so nothing ever happens at all. And I think we consistently see so many of the political leaders posture that they're doing things for black people, they're doing things for the LGBTQ community. And anytime you come and you testify and you raise up these issues, then they want to create some sort of cosmetic program. And quite frankly, I mean, I hate to be too direct here, but it's directed at people in this room. I mean, by and large, if you look at Muriel Bowser and many of the people on the council, the vast majority of their political programming and messaging is aimed at younger people, newer to the city, with more resources and the things they care about. So if you look at the polls of what millennials, quote unquote, care about, and then those are the things that they're going to message to, and they, quite frankly, often trick people. They say, well, we spent $100 million on affordable housing. What they don't tell you is that's only 1,000 units a year, when in fact you're actually getting tens of thousands of market rate units built every year, and you've already lost 30,000 in the past 10 years. So as they're doing their tiny little bit about what they're doing, the problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think it's extraordinarily important to recognize that, because this is not like South Carolina. This is not Mississippi. Like, form and content are so key, because the form of every single government program is to speak to almost all of what we're saying. And in fact, oftentimes use the same words. And in fact, sometimes hire people out of our movements to speak it right back to us. But the content of it is nowhere to be found. And I think that's an important reality about the District of Columbia that I think has to be grasped. And then the nature of our organizing has to also be planned against that. Oftentimes, at least rhetorically, they're going to try to make it seem like we won, when in fact we've won nothing.
So, you know, speaking of that, that's why, you know, the Workers' Center is so important, because, and you know, in the labor and the other organizations that I've dealt with, it's a lot of politics. And, you know, and I remember when I first got started in this, and I was like, oh, yes, you know, we're doing this and we're doing that. And you know, people were like, yeah, yeah. And then I looked behind me and there was nobody there. And, you know, and I know you guys have felt that feeling like, oh, my gosh, like, what happened? You know, when you first get in this type of work and you're all excited or whatever, and then, you know, the D.C. Council, they pass these laws and these things like that, and then we go out and I speak to workers, and I'm like, okay, well, did you know that you had these rights? And nobody knew. And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to do something about it, and then it's like, no, we're really not, you know. And we've been down to the D.C., since we have a D.C. Attorney General now, thank God, which, you know, I hope that they do something, because once again, like he just said, I say all the time, D.C. is dressed up and nowhere to go.
Come on.
Okay? The whole truth is, I mean, we have, you know, and a lot of people, you see different people going from different organizations because we thought that one organization was going to take care of this and was going to be different, but it then all turned around to be the same thing. And that's the same way with, as far as the jobs in D.C. are concerned. You'll find a lot of people, you know, you'll say, well, why don't they just leave that job and go to the next one? They're all dressed up with the same language. They're all sitting at the table just like we're sitting at the table. And they already have their agenda for 20 years. It's already stacked. So then when we have a D.C., we have a government that then has all of these nice little pretty laws, but nobody is enforcing them. So, you know, you might come and say, well, you know, this is a great city. This is that. No, we're all dressed up and nowhere to go.
Thank you for that. And talking about accountability and making sure that people aren't complacent in that struggle, I think that's important and really is a good segue into wrapping up. We're going to combine a couple questions and talk about how does redistributing wealth go beyond donations or charitable giving? And then also including our identities and all our experiences, and how can you live and act in solidarity with Black labor and on the future of D.C.?
So basically how we can help this is that a couple of years ago when Bill Clinton wanted to make sure that everybody had a home, well, you know what? Everybody in D.C. did have a home. And due to the crisis with the banks, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, I hear people say, oh, well, you know, people should have known better. No, it was a setup. It was a setup from the start. And so what has happened is that people, you know, they lost their homes. It was the American dream. And a lot of people had the American dream. And then we saw over time how, you know, the flex interest rates, how they went up. And then next thing we know, we have everybody being put out of their homes. So what we need to organize around is housing. You know, we have our housing projects in the district that, you know, that are being tore up and they're being displaced. But we actually had homeowners. And so I grew up in a home. I actually, at one point in time, I had four houses in the District of Columbia before buying houses were popular. So I'm in a home now, and I'm teaching my daughter how to be a homeowner. Not only that, the legacy that I'm leaving her is another home, because I have a home that she can then move in and then hopefully afford to stay in the city. So if you're being displaced and you can't, without a home in the district, it's nothing that you can really do. Like she said, as far as being busy and things like that, if you have to worry about where you're going to live at, you know, if you're going to be able to have a house or a roof, or if you got to move down Wardoff, because for all of you who do know, might not know, PG County was considered as Ward 9. It's 8 wards in D.C. PG County was considered as Ward 9. Well, guess what? Ward 9 said no more. They're now shipping folks down Wardoff. And so, you know, we talk about not having jobs. You know, you're talking about sending somebody way down the road. So that has to stop. And that was not, you know, people didn't just give up their houses. People lost their houses. It was a setup. So that's the biggest thing, and that's part of what everybody should be concerned about. And not just for us or for them, but for yourselves, because they're also pricing you guys out. And so this is not just a one fight. This is everybody's fight to make sure that everybody can afford to be able to sustain itself in the city, because the city is selling everything that's not tied down. And they're not really concerned about us, any of us in this room. So that's the fight for me.
I'm only smiling because you mentioned Waldorf. I was talking to somebody about that the other day. They put out a meme that was like, what's the move on Friday? Oh, it's in Waldorf. Oh, you got to give me a week. Yeah, you don't want to go down to Waldorf, but you have to now. It's like people down there. Anyway,
wow.
You know, I'm a big believer in Rockville too. Places that you used to never go. It's like, man, what, Gaithersburg? You get out to Gaithersburg. You know, I don't even know where that is. Sixth grade geography champion too. You know, I'm a big believer that movements should operate under the principle of equality of sacrifice, right? And I think that, like, for example, 1DC, one of the hosting events here, everyone who's a member pays dues. And, you know, in equality of sacrifice, it's not about, like, what necessarily the exact number is, but it's about, you know, whatever you do, it should feel like a sacrifice. It should feel like you're committing to something.
I have a question for Kimberly about labor unions, particularly for black workers. What's the importance of labor unions?
Well, why it's important for the labor unions is because, basically, you're looking at the health care and everything going up as far as the benefits are concerned. So what we have to do, not only we have to educate people about organizing, and the reason why they're organizing for the unions is because we need to get the better benefits. So if you're like the Fight for 15, you know, we've been fighting for 15, but we know as a labor union, we already in our contracts, we're already to negotiating higher wages, better benefits, longer vacations, short-term disabilities, long-term disabilities. We have a more insight inside of the companies when they're unionized to get those benefits, regardless of the district or any other government does not pass it. So we have a ability to how to promote these benefits, regardless of who else promotes it. So that's why it's the importance of the to getting organized. Just like I meant to say, in regards to the Home Depot. In regards, you know, it's nothing wrong with having that job, but the first thing I wanted to say was that unit had been organized, we could have gone in and got them those trades. You know, hey, why not, if you're in this business, why not give them the trade, organize them and get the trade so then they can also get higher benefits and a better salary and maybe go out and get some contract jobs and do their own job. So it's just more of an insight movement, and it's a faster movement. Even though we're going outside to try to get the government to do what we know is right, we can't wait on them. So it has to be done any way necessary.
So this year marks like the 50th year of Call for Black Power.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know what you thought were the most important issues and trends for black labor in terms of 50 years ago in D.C. and now. I know one of the things you mentioned, Eugene, was the whole issue of tracking people and putting people in these career schools. But I know a lot of people wish that there was training, like, say, apprenticeships, so that people could be going to, like, plumbing and electrician, because sometimes you can have better living with that as opposed to a college degree when you can't, like, get a job. So I wonder if you had any thoughts, like, 50 years ago and that.
I think the biggest challenge, quite frankly, challenging black labor right now, as opposed to 50 years ago, is grappling with the changes in the labor market between now and then. I mean, I think 50 years ago, to a large degree, the issue was black people trying to get into workforces that they were excluded from. And I think now that's the same struggle to some degree, but I think the bigger challenge is that there's another low-wage workforce that's being brought into the country, and the biggest challenge is how to build solidarity across racial lines and across national and ethnic boundaries in order to build stronger movements. For example, you know, I mentioned DC Jobs or Else. When we used to go and shut down these construction sites, we used to get the tips from the Latino workers who were against the racism on the sites that would then call in and say, these are the places where they're telling us, like the people who work there now are telling us, like, yeah, we will never hire black people at any of these places, so you should definitely go there. So like a way of building more of that functional type of solidarity, which speaks to the, I think, the broader point too about the apprenticeships is, I mean, we have to change the context in which we are in what really is a zero-sum labor market. I mean, there's only a certain amount of jobs that exist. And craft jobs, and I tried to get one of those plumbing apprenticeships. I couldn't even get in there. But the whole basis of a craft job having a high wage scale is the fact that they will only allow in a certain number of workers. And the whole thing is all based on exclusionary labor practices. So even if everyone wanted to get in a plumbing apprenticeship, the good jobs that they have now would cease to become those types of jobs as soon as everyone was in it, because then you would sort of lose the craft reality of how it's set up. So I think that's another sort of maybe sort of meta challenge. And I don't know, that's a challenge that I don't know if it can really be met under the paradigm of capitalism in America. And I think that was the question that became the question 50 years ago when black power was raised as a context. I don't think that it's any real coincidence that Kwame Ture, who originally raised the slogan, that Mukasa Willie Ricks, who was also there, who previewed the slogan all across the Black Belt, and many of those other individuals had moved from a paradigm of seeking Black power as a form of self-determination inside of the capitalist system to a revolutionary socialist posture of trying to overthrow the system, because their analysis was, certainly the Black Panthers, League of Revolutionary Black Workers, was the entire reality of Black power, which was beyond representational Black power, but the control of capital and resources in order to build up and direct the resources in a community in a way that was truly self-determining, was not capable under the current economic system. And I think that was a question then that was raised by most of the people who raised Black power. Then that movement was brutally suppressed via COINTELPRO and the creation, quite frankly, of the nonprofit industrial complex. Read Robert Allen's Black Awakening in Capitalist America, and you'll see why it is the way it is. And it still remains a question today, because that movement now, I think, is coming back very strongly, and a lot of those unanswered questions that were short-circuited are coming back to the fore.
It's not all bad, okay? Because especially for, you know, people of color, this is a struggle we've been fighting for slavery since we've been here. You know, we're a blessed people. We will make do with what we have. But the whole thing is that we've been making do too long, especially here in Washington, D.C. I mean, I have been through Reaganomics. I have been through the war on drugs. I have been through the murder capital. Mm. I mean, my blood, my ancestors' blood, sweat, and tears is in the grounds of this city. So why is it now, at the new height of the city, I should be displaced? Or you should be displaced. I mean, what are we really doing here? I mean, I always try to remind people that, do we not remember what just happened in Baltimore not too long ago? Do we not think that that cannot happen here in the nation's capital? And if anybody thinks that they are not in reality of what's going on, and unfortunately a lot of people are not in reality of what's going on because they only see things as they see now. But the truth of the matter is that scares me. Because I don't want any of us or anybody to be burning down my community. I like to see the city thrive, but I need to make sure that I can thrive with it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when I speak, people, you know, I don't mean to sound like the mean Black woman. It's actually my passion that I have for the, I'm a native Washingtonian. I can't tell you how many times when I say that to somebody, they're shocked. They're like, oh my gosh, I've never met a native right in Washingtonian. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, my fault. We're all over 7 and 8 right now with no jobs. Mm. But we're still here, and I still want to be here. Mm. And I want to be your neighbor, your neighbor, your neighbor. And so we are very hopeful.
You've been listening to activist Eugene Perrier, labor leader Kimberly Mitchell, and Ime Ho. This program is being presented as part of our coverage this month of Black Power, 50 Years in D.C., 1966 to 2016, which is supported by a grant from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities. And that will do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. A special thanks to Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, and Michael Byfield for their contributions to the show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. Reach our show at onthegroundshow.org. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Avarum. I'll be participating in the closing reception tonight for X-Exchange, a showcase of women artists and makers at Area 405 Gallery in Baltimore. Raise your voice. Peace.